The Verona Quartet is about to begin their second season as the Quartet in Residence at Oberlin College. They also recently released their debut recording. It's called Diffusion. We'll find out more about this new recording this week on New Classical Tracks from American Public Media. I'm Julie Almacher. I'd love to start off by having each of you introduce yourselves. Tell me a little bit about, you know, who you are, your roots, and your musical path so far, which led you to the Verona Quartet. Why don't we start with you, Abigail?
I'm Abigail Rodjansky. I'm the violist of the Verona Quartet, and I'm also a founding member of the quartet. I'm originally from the San Francisco Bay Area, born and raised, and I came out to Oberlin Conservatory for my undergraduate degree. And from there, I went to Indiana University, where I did my master's, but that's also where I met Jonathan Ong, our first violinist, and where the quartet was formed. And at the time, we were playing with two other players, but very shortly after forming, our second violinist, Dorothy Rowe, joined us. And she's originally from Canada. And Jonathan, I should say, is from Singapore. And a few years after that, the chap we have here, Jonathan Dormond, we affectionately refer to him as JD, came along.
So Abigail, just tell me a little bit about how the viola became your primary instrument. What led you to be the inner voice of the quartet?
Music was always very important to my family. And my aunt is a composer, I have a cousin who's a conductor. Nobody in my immediate family are musicians, but everybody loves music. And so learning how to read music and how to play an instrument was really crucial. And my grandfather was the one who actually, he had a little violin in the closet and he started teaching me. And so I played the violin for a number of years, and I ended up going to a very special school for about fourth to ninth grade in the Bay Area called the Crowden School. It was a music day school. So all the students there played an instrument, and we would play chamber music and play an orchestra and sing in a choir. We studied music theory, music history, but also math, science, and all the rest of it. And while I was there, all of the violinists were required to play the viola. So that's where the seed was planted. But that seed grew in a big way. I continued playing both instruments throughout high school. And when I came to Oberlin, when I went to college, it was my opportunity to sort of decide, well, do I want to pick one direction or the other? And I decided to pick the viola because I had played it in chamber music sort of all through my adolescence. And I found a special bond with it. I felt as though I was meant to be the sort of glue voice, the voice that glued everybody together and was sort of highly influential, but kind of from behind the scenes. I loved that. I even wrote my college entrance essay about wanting to play in a string quartet. Of course, at the time, I had no idea what that really meant. but I'm so glad that I was able to make that dream a reality.
What have you discovered that it means to be in a string quartet and to have founded this quartet? What does that mean to you now?
Oh, gosh. I mean, the definition, if you can even define what it is, it's going to grow, you know, from year to year, it's already grown. And my understanding of what it means, so to speak, will certainly change. But I guess I just had a strong passion for the repertoire. And I loved the manner of communication. I loved that I owned my own voice. But there was a part of me that I also in some ways needed to sacrifice for something greater. And I guess instinctively, I kind of felt there was this magic to the live conversation, musical conversation amongst four voices. And that certainly has proved true. But the lifestyle, I think I never could have pictured what it would be like, you know, traveling, well, prior to COVID, certainly, traveling all the time and the intensity of rehearsals and just all of it. I mean, there are so many aspects to it that I think you can't understand until you're actually in it.
Jonathan, how about you? Introduce yourself, pronounce your full name, and do you prefer to go by Jonathan or JD?
You can call me JD, but I am Jonathan Dormond, affectionately known as JD. by the Verona Quartet. And I am the cellist of the quartet, and I'm originally from the UK. And I came to the United States in 2010 to pursue my master's. I really wanted to study with a cellist named Lawrence Lesser. That was a really fantastic experience. It was a completely different sort of experience to what it was in conservatory life in the UK, if you like, coming to the United States, and in some ways a little bit more traditional, actually, than it was in the UK, which I really enjoyed. And then I went on to study at USC in Los Angeles with my sort of childhood idol, actually, is a cellist, Ralph Kirschbaum. And then after quite a bit of study, I thought, well, what's the thing to do now? And so I went back to the UK, and I took some auditions for some orchestras, and I got very lucky that I got trials. There's a trial system in the UK, and I worked a lot with the Philharmonia Orchestra, BBC National Orchestra of Wales, Royal Northern Symphonia, and I got to play in principal positions with those orchestras as well, and it was a fantastic experience. And I think coming out of being a student and, you know, going into immediately this sort of professional working life, I wasn't really sure that I should really like this or not. And I really, obviously, music is my, you know, first passion, but playing in orchestra, I thought it was the thing and I was really enjoying it. But then one day I got an email out of the blue from the Verona Quartet asking, you know, would you consider coming to do the sort of audition process with the quartet? And I thought about it. And initially, my initial reaction was, no, you know, I'm really set doing what I'm doing now. And then I realized that, yeah, I want to take that audition, actually. I want to go and see what that's all about. Anyway, I went to New York and I did the audition with the rest of the quartet. And it was a fantastic experience. And I'm glad that after they offered me that position, no looking back and finding that sort of sense of community. And it's sort of a different sort of lifestyle, if you like, to the orchestral life. And the way that you sort of pick up what you've been working on from one day to the next, as opposed to having a completely new program. I mean, it's just such a unique experience to be a string quartet musician, and one that I relish that challenge.
And I imagine, too, that you discovered you could still find ways to practice and perform even during COVID, which was certainly an advantage over being in a full orchestra, right?
Exactly. I mean, the fact that we can continue that work together and keep growing with, even though the challenges are different, maybe you're not on the road or whatever a regular week might look like, but instead we're able to find a new working pattern together, and one that you can work around, but continue to still work on this incredible repertoire and the wealth of repertoire that the quartet is so lucky to have.
I am guessing, Abigail, that you can answer this question. Why is the ensemble called the Verona Quartet?
Yes, I can. That's a great question. Verona is really a tribute to Shakespeare. And more importantly, we wanted to pay homage to a great artist or a great storyteller from outside the genre of music, because we believe very strongly that music is just one of the great avenues for telling important and meaningful stories. So we really wanted to pay homage to the greatest storyteller of all time.
You're beginning your second year as Oberlin's Ensemble in Residence. Why is this an important opportunity for the Verona Quartet?
It's very important to have a home base for a variety of reasons. Of course, a string quartet is historically a sort of migratory ensemble. We can pick up and move anywhere at a moment's notice, and that's one of the great benefits of being a string quartet. But to have a home base for us gives us a sense of, you know, stability, but it also allows us to convey, you know, what we have to share both musically and as teachers, which is very important to us as the Verona Quartet, in a consistent way. So while we do work with students everywhere that we go, when we travel, when we're touring, when we're here, we can really invest in students consistently. And that's very special. And on top of that, of course, Oberlin is just a remarkable place to be involved with and to be related to. You know, it's a tiny little town and a very low population in the town and in the college, but a low population of very, very special people.
And Abigail, you're also an alum of Oberlin. I'm wondering, does this residency take on special meaning for you, perhaps?
It does. When I say it's a small population of special people, really, honestly, I'm just flattering myself. But yes, I'm an OB, and so getting to be in Oberlin with my quartet is an opportunity I actually didn't imagine I would have, and it's an incredible honor in sort of every avenue.
Can one of you describe the mission of the Verona Quartet?
Well, I think that first and foremost, music is about community. And I think the way that we approach our sort of artistic vision together, it's an incredibly collaborative spirit. And the music that is so vast for the string quartet, we have an incredible interest in all of that, actually. So it's not that we particularly have only play Haydn or only play contemporary music. We like it all. And we do have a particular interest sometimes in the early 20th century music, partially because it's just such a fascinating period of time for so many reasons. But in terms of that, back to community, it's really important that we invest in not only in the community in which we live right now at Oberlin, but in the communities that we go and perform concerts to. Because being able to make a connection with everybody that you perform for is so vital to the legacy of music. And I think bringing that collaborative spirit that is chamber music to everybody and understanding that you're welcome into this intimate world of such fantastic masterpieces, and that you can become such almost a better person through a chamber music and collaborative experience, the way that we work with one another, that you really allow yourself to listen from another person's point of view and really take that point of view on as though it is your own. I think it offers us a fantastic opportunity to grow as people, but also that we can really invest in those around us, but also really and just enjoy that experience, I think.
The quartet, as you mentioned, Abigail, represents the nations of Canada, Singapore, the UK, and the US. I'm wondering, how does that impact who you are as an ensemble and the work that you do?
The coming together of our four national identities is really crucial to the collaborative spirit that we bring to the work we do every single day. We understand intimately the idea of stepping outside of yourself, learning about somebody else, and becoming a greater, better individual and a greater society, more unified society through that. And so that's really where the album was born as well, because we wanted to make our first album, our debut album, a celebration of this, you know, cross-cultural connection and the idea of cultural migration, which is underpins our identity as an ensemble.
You've just released your debut recording, Diffusion. What is most exciting to you about this debut release? Do you want to answer first, JD?
Sure, yeah. Well, this album is really obviously our first, and I think it serves as a calling card in a way to a little bit of the insight of what we're about and what our interests are about. But it's more than that. It's that the music itself is so fantastic, and the way that it tells either a story through the Janáček Intimate Letters, although it's not exactly a sort of narrative, if you like, it's more a story through feeling. And I think this whole album really, even though the Ravel and the Szymanowski, they don't necessarily spell that out, they have that same sort of journey that you take through the music. And I think as performers, that's something that we find really important, and the way that we can enhance our own music playing and really be able to put that out sort of as our first calling card.
You have anything to add to that, Abigail?
I would certainly second my colleague's comments. Our debut album is, in many ways for us, it's a culmination of a chapter in our quartet life. And at the same time, it's the beginning of a new chapter. And I think that kind of moment in time is very important to us and very meaningful to us. But to the listener, I think a lot can be drawn from this repertoire. As JD mentioned, it's drawn from a period of time when there was incredible innovation in many avenues, right? Not just music and art, but in technology. And this was an opportunity for people to really learn about cultures far beyond themselves. And so what we're doing here is we're looking back at this incredible time in history through a musical lens to learn something about how we can progress into the future. And if I may make a comment that may refer back, this is an aside, may refer back to when you were asking about our mission. We really see ourselves as a traditional string quartet, but not in the traditional definition of that word. We don't just play old music. We don't just play the tried and true pieces that everybody thinks are classical. We're in the business of paving the way for what tradition will become. And we can really do that best by looking at our history, learning from it, and taking brave steps into the future. So that's what this album is. It's looking back, learning, finding the beauty, and then turning and looking into the future and making choices and taking steps forward in the right direction.
All right, well, let's talk about the pieces that are featured on this recording. The three works on Diffusion are exploring a mosaic of folk cultures. Why is that exploration important to you?
Well, I think that period of time, the earliest 20th century, sort of going back now 100 years or so plus, or give or take on this album, you have in a style of playing, for instance, very national identities. And what you're really looking at now is with the new technology, with trains and the exploration of, it's just been so much easier to get from one culture to another. That idea of the blend between that arises in the music, I think. So in a way, if you're looking at it from the perspective of the album, in the Ravel, you have this, obviously it's a very French style of writing that and a nationalistic style of writing, but at the same time it takes influence from music such as the gamelan music from Indonesia. But it's all about how you take from one culture but you have explored it and made it your own. And I think that's in a way what we've also tried to do with our playing, is we really try to look back to this fantastic music and learn from those traditions, but how do we make it our own and how do we try and put our stamp on it, at least for that snapshot in time of when it was recorded? And for instance, whenever we do performance, one of the great joys of doing a performance, of course, is the idea that this is music is a fleeting thing that happens just in that moment. And if you're not in that room, you've missed that sort of point of view, if you like. And the next time it may evolve, because that's just the nature of the process that we're involved in. So I think the music that we're looking at here is trying to get at that, but just obviously it's in that snapshot in this album.
Ravel's string quartet in F major is the composer's only string quartet. He wrote it early in his career, yet eventually it did become known as one of his masterpieces. Why? Why is this considered to be such a masterpiece?
Well, as you say, it's his only string quartet. So the string quartet is such an important genre, and for a great composer to have had only one, it was bound to become so important to our field. But if you look at the piece, it's masterfully written, but in terms of its form and its breaking with tradition and building also upon history. And so he greatly respected Debussy and was heard the Debussy quartet, who of course only wrote one string quartet as well. And he loved it, but he thought that there were aspects of it that could have been improved. I mean, that's hard to believe, but it's true. And so that was sort of, in some ways, his response to it. But of course, the Ravel Quartet also met criticism, especially the last movement. People thought it didn't have enough of a melody, it was too fast, it was in this, you know, uncomfortable rhythm. Now we look at that with hindsight and we say, my goodness, this last movement is so spectacular, and it led to so much more spectacular and innovative writing.
Can you give an example?
I mean, I think just the coloration and the way that he sort of orchestrates for the string quartet, it could remind me of anything from the La Valse, which obviously includes that sort of homage, if you like, even though I know that Ravel wasn't the biggest fan of the Viennese waltz, partially why he wrote this sort of overly grand waltz. But I think even the way that he writes for the piano, so like Miroir, I think this music is all in there. It's got this magical flavor that is almost, it's in the air, the harmonies. And it's something that you can't quite grasp, but yet you really want to be able to listen to that. But additionally, what also strikes me about this last movement is a very sort of his Spanish, his Basque heritage, if you like. And so you have these very sort of, for lack of a better word, very like masculine, sort of Spanish rhythms at the beginning with the sort of the tremolo strings and the pizzas. And that could be anything like Rhapsody Espanol, the music of Ravel. So I think obviously it just set the foundations for all of the fantastic pieces that he would go on to write and that we know and we love.
In the Szymanowski, the opening of that quartet is reminiscent of Ravel. Yet he also establishes his own voice. Can you talk a little bit more about how he creates his unique voice in this genre?
Well, Szymanowski is a fantastic composer, and definitely a composer that we could all bear to hear a little bit more of his music more frequently, I think. And it has this incredible mysticism in the music. And it begins from almost like coming out of the mist. And to me, the beginning of this quartet, and this is a personal image, this is not based on anything exact, but it almost reminds me of the music of the, you know, the Greek, the sirens. Sort of almost being summoned in a way to your, I don't want to say this takes you to your doom, but it has a very compelling quality to it that you just can't resist. And it begins from so far away, the music. It has this hyper-romanticism about it that I think, I just don't know another composer that writes like this, but incredibly lyrical, but at the same time, just so Moorish and delicious in the harmonies. But he just has his own unique take on everything. I'm quite obsessed with this piece, actually.
The second movement also kind of blasts us out of our seats. I'm not going to lie. I was listening and went, whoa! I mean, in that scherzando, talk about the power and the forcefulness that we hear there.
Yeah. Well, that second movement, you're not supposed to pick favorites, so don't tell anybody, but I think it might be my favorite movement for exactly the reason that you said. It's attacca from the first to second movements, and it comes and it whips you in the face, and it's so fun to do that to the audience. It's such fun to play, but I think if you think about with the Ravel, you know, he was incorporating, obviously, bits of, you know, Indonesian gamelan music, and he was in many of his works inspired by jazz, and you can actually almost hear the suggestion of that in the quartet. Well, think of sort of the same concept, but in the Szymanowski. In this case, he's weaving in and out these sort of folk rhythms and folk textures, and actually is some adapted folk melodies. And I say adapted because remember, this is art music. So what they're doing is this incredible, it's not a replica of folk music. They're taking the sort of essence of something that is so inspiring to them and or so meaningful, and they're meeting these worlds with the classical string quartet genre. And they've done it in these, all three of these composers have done it in their own very, very unique ways. And yet the notion of these meetings of the worlds and weaving together these folk traditions with the classical genre, it brings them together. It is a unifying factor. You know, Szymanowski, he takes these glissando figures and he layers them against this incredibly powerful melody in the middle of the second movement. The melody is in the cello, but it's almost obliterated by these sort of wailing, shouting glissando figures that are crashing one into the other, these upper three voices. And that's just, to me, that's the greatest example of this kind of crashing together of the traditions. And it creates something that it's so visceral, even thinking about it gives me chills, and I'm the performer.
Hey, that's awesome, though. Think about that. When you work on something for so long and it still gives you chills, that says a lot about the piece, really.
That's a masterwork.
Lajos Janáček's String Quartet No. 2, known as Intimate Letters, was written later in his career. He was about 63, and he was really energized by unrequited love. How does that passion come through in this string quartet?
Well, this quartet is one of the most beloved string quartets for very good reasons. And I, as the violist, of course, have to especially love it. It was originally written not for the viola, but for the viola d'amore. He had to write it for the viola of love, of course. It's so dramatic, and it's considered his manifesto on love. Well, it was, in my opinion, it's the culmination, it's the final letter, a culmination of over 700 love letters that he wrote to a woman who was a third of his age, who was in fact married, with whom he was completely obsessed. And his letters, if you read some of them, if you have a lot of time on your hands, you can read all of them. they're incredibly dramatic, the language that he uses. And one idea, one very over-energized idea will break, and suddenly he'll say something completely different, an entirely different emotional character, an entirely different subject, an entirely different mode of expression. And he does exactly that in this quartet, and that's part of what makes it so incredibly dramatic, almost like film scene changes. Suddenly it goes black and then there's something completely different. It's a piece that is, you have to get really into the Janáček mindset, as I said, where the Ravel has its own tone. The Szymanowski has its own tone. Well, the Janáček has a tone that was truly Janáček. Nobody else could write like that before him.
Abigail Rojansky and Jonathan Dormond of the Verona Quartet talking about their debut recording, Diffusion. If you're enjoying New Classical Tracks, the best thing that you can do for the show is tell somebody else about it, help spread the word, and take a moment to rate and review us on your podcasting app. And since you're clearly a music fan, let me tell you about the Piano Puzzler podcast, where every week, Fred Child invites composer Bruce Adolph into the studio to play one of his brilliant musical mind games. Bruce takes a familiar tune, disguises it in the style of a classical composer, and then a contestant calls in to try to solve the riddle. It's a lot of fun. And if you're up for the challenge, you can subscribe to the Piano Puzzler wherever you get your podcasts. This podcast is New Classical Tracks from American Public Media. I'm Julia Marker.